Welcome to the College Commons Podcast, passionate perspectives from Judaism's leading thinkers, brought to you by HUC Connect, the Hebrew Union College's online platform for continuing education. I'm Joshua Holo, your host. Welcome to this episode of the College Commons Podcast and our conversation with Aaron Hurt Mannheimer. Aaron Hurt Mannheimer is the former editor of Reform Judaism magazine from 1976 to 2014 and founding editor of the trailblazing Davka magazine from 1970 to 76, a West Coast Jewish quarterly. His books include Jägendorf's Foundry, a memoir of the Romanian Holocaust, which came out in 1991, and Jews, the Essence and Character of a People, which came out in 1998, with Arthur Hertzberg. Together with his longtime friend Marty Urar, he recently wrote Sons of Survivors, Making Peace with Inherited Trauma, which is the subject of our conversation today. Aaron Hurt Mannheimer, thank you for joining us on the College Commons Podcast.
Thank you for having me. It's a delight to be here.
In her foreword to the book, Sons of Survivors, Dr. Yael Danieli picks up on a key tension in the experience of children of survivors. That is, the desire to know and not to know. How has the balance between these two desires shifted for you in the course of your life?
Growing up, my parents did talk about the Holocaust, but only to a limited degree in a very fragmented way. I knew about some of the key episodes in their Holocaust experience. I knew that my father and mother were both engaged in 1941 when their towns in Poland were occupied by the Nazis. They had an engagement in my mother's town, and a week later, they were going to have one in my father's town. And before that could happen, my mother was picked up and taken to a concentration camp. So I've known that all my life. I also know of two episodes toward the end of the war about their liberation. I knew that my mother was on a death march over 3 months, and when she could no longer walk, she was forced on a truck with 20 other women to be driven to the nearby forest and shot. Just then, a U.S. fighter plane flew overhead, strafed the truck, hit the two women, German guards, in the back of the truck, and none of the prisoners. At that moment, my mother jumped off the truck, somehow managed to find the strength, ran into a forest, and that was May 5th, 1945. So the story of the day that her captivity ended on this brutal death march, it was a story that we knew. There was a death march, she jumped off a truck. We didn't know anything about when that happened, why that happened. For my father, we knew that after Auschwitz was evacuated, he jumped off the train, cattle car, and he was shot through the chest. He was left to die along the railroad tracks. Some local people picked him up, took him to a hospital. They patched him up, saw his Auschwitz number on his arm, and called the Gestapo. He was then transferred to Mauthausen concentration camp for special punishment as an escapee, even though he was barely alive. I later found out that that was 3 weeks from the time he left Auschwitz to the time he was in Mauthausen. He managed to survive till May 5th. He was on a pile of bodies, basically a living skeleton, when U.S. forces liberated the camp, and he survived the very same day that my mother escaped. For all those years, they were engaged but didn't know what happened to each other, and then they found one another after the war. I only realized when we finished the book, almost, that I had never spoken to my father about the Holocaust. never had a conversation about the Holocaust. I had never asked. What little I learned later was from my sister, because when she was in her early 20s, she wanted to write a paper about how the Holocaust impacted her life. So she had a conversation with my father and wrote it down. So this was very valuable information, which I didn't even know until I started writing the book. So in many ways, they were reluctant to talk about it, and Marty and I were reluctant to ask. Now, Marty's parents, my co-author, never talked about the Holocaust. In fact, there was a conspiracy of silence. They told the aunts, the uncles, the cousins, anyone close to Marty, never to talk about what happened to their father in particular. Marty was 20 years old when he learned that his father had had a family before the Holocaust, a wife and two daughters who were killed. We wanted to know, but we didn't want to know too much. They didn't want to tell us too much, but we wanted to know as much as we could. But not only to know what happened to them, but how it affected us, how it impacted us at every stage of our lives.
Effectively, I hear you saying that the desire not to know gave way over time and with age to the desire to know. And so this paradox or tension that Dr. Daniele points out shifted over the course of your life. And it sounds like it's a function of maturation and aging yourself and your own internal processes of relating to your parents the way we all do as we ourselves change. Is that accurate?
That is accurate. And also, we each have three children and grandchildren. So we did come to this later in life. And we wanted to know how our being sons of survivors impacted our children. So as part of the book, we interviewed our children and really found out for the first time what their take was on being third generation. And even in the book, one of my granddaughters at age of 9 wrote a story for a public school assignment just on her own, in which she placed herself in my mother's shoes during the Holocaust and did it in such a remarkable way that there was no doubt in my mind that she had inherited the trauma. In fact, when I asked her, why did she write this? She said, I wanted to get a better idea of what it was like for grandma when she escaped from the death march. So you see, it goes from generation to generation, and everybody wants to know to a degree.
I'm touched by your friendship with your co-author, Marty Jura. You were close friends in youth, sons of Yiddish-speaking Holocaust survivors in 1960s Los Angeles, and that's the root of your bond. Your paths then diverged in adulthood, and you reunited after decades, ultimately writing this book together. So before we return to the Holocaust and the phenomenon of transgenerational trauma, I want to ask you about your friendship. I think we all get intuitively, or indeed from our own experience, how it is that early shared history establishes a special bond. Tell us, in different fashion, however, how it is that years of separation, paradoxically, can themselves actually strengthen that bond.
Yes, over several decades, we would only communicate twice a year, when I would call him to wish him a happy birthday, and he would call me. So we kept the connection. However, we didn't see each other and really didn't know what we were into and what we were doing, and in fact had some false impressions of one another. Sometimes things happen by circumstance or seeming serendipitously. What happened was my daughter and her husband and young son were flying from LA to New York, and they had a stopover in Atlanta. There was a storm and they were stuck at the airport. My daughter called me and said, what are we going to do? We have no place to go. I said, I have a friend in Atlanta, Marty. Here's his number, give him a call, and I'm sure he'll help. Well, Marty came to the rescue. It happened to be Christmas Eve, 2016. He took them in, the extended family was having a Christmas celebration, big dinner, everything. They took them in, and they were treated like family. The next day, my daughter called and said, Dad, I don't understand why you and Marty never see one another. You know, the atmosphere in their home is just like yours. Even the tchotchkes are the same, the art on the walls. So I took that in and shared that with Marty. And it just turned out that they were going to be coming to New York in a few months. We got together. We rebonded like brothers. And at that moment, I looked at his face. So many years had gone by. He looked exactly like his father. So I was with his father and with him at the same time. So that's how it began. We started having some conversation. And I knew that kind of in the background, there were questions about where we came from. It was in that context, pretty much, that it really became clear that our fathers were in the same camp, Auschwitz, that our fathers were from the same town, that our mothers were from neighboring towns, that our mothers were both in concentration camps, in the Gross-Rosen complex of camps, and that we were conceived in the same displaced persons camp. We didn't know that. I was born there in Feldafing in the U.S. zone of Germany, and his mom was pregnant there, and he was born once they landed in New York. How this book happened was some months later, he called me. He's very open to Buddhism and Eastern religions. He was reading a book called The Dude and the Zen Master by Jeff Bridges and a Jewish Zen master. And in that book, he learned that they sponsor a retreat to Auschwitz, a meditation retreat. And he called me, said, what do you think? Should I go on this? Would you like to go? And I said, well, I've been to Auschwitz several times, and that's really not my thing, but I really think you should go. He went. When he came back, he told me about it. He wrote an article for reformjudaism.org, which I was editing. And then a couple months later, he said, you know, people have been saying maybe I should write a book about what it was like growing up as a child of survivors. And I said, why don't we do it together? And that's how the book came to be.
I wonder if those years of separation might be a bit like a rubber band. The more you stretch out the separation, actually the greater force with which you come back to each other. And if that force of recolliding, re-encountering in this creative and constructive way might have only happened by virtue of the distance that you had experienced from one another for all those decades.
Yes, that's the perfect metaphor. That's exactly what happened. When we came together, it was so profound. Just thinking about how this happened, how it was so unexpected. You know, if that event at the airport hadn't happened, if the storm hadn't happened, then this book wouldn't have happened. So clearly, there was something very dramatic and dynamic in our coming together that led to 6 years of research and exploration together, leaning on each other as we learned some truths that were very hard to take. But doing it together made a huge difference.
The College Commons podcast belongs to HUC Connect, the online platform for continuing education from the Hebrew Union College. HUC Connect includes webinars, syllabi for community learning, and masterclasses for HUC alumni, with interviews, expert panels, and classroom materials on topics ranging from the arts to civil society, Israel, and much more. Check us out at huc.edu/HUC Connect. Now, back to our interview.
The book is told in exchanges of voices, you, then Marty, throughout and in the course of the chapters. And Marty, in one of his sections, points out that his parents came to the United States as refugees, greeted by an already American family. He had that advantage. And generally, this American family received them very warmly. However, one couple in his family kept their distance from Marty's nuclear family. As Marty writes, like so many American Jews of that time, they were uncomfortable around Grina, refugees who bore the emotional scars of the Holocaust. As Marty describes, discomforts of being confronted with the challenges and suffering of others is something of a commonplace. We know this. The routine explanation for this phenomenon of our discomfort around other people's suffering or challenges, this explanation tends to point to the fact that challenges, tragedies, and losses of others trigger our own fears and surface our own vulnerabilities. That explanation has always left me a little bit unsatisfied. I don't really buy it. Do you buy that explanation? And if not, where do you think that discomfort comes from?
In the case of Holocaust survivors, it was maybe a unique kind of situation. The survivors, first of all, they thought that their stories of what happened to them would make a difference in the world. The leaders of the survivors certainly did. People thought that people would want to hear their stories, and then they were surprised that people didn't want to hear their stories. But it was more than that. It was kind of like the sense that maybe they had done something immoral to survive, because the odds of surviving in Poland, it was 1 out of 100, 1%. So what did you do in order to beat the odds? If you were a woman, did you prostitute yourself? If you were a man, were you a cop, or did you take advantage of the situation at the expense of others? So they were kind of suspected of doing something wrong. To expand this, the publishing world had no interest in publishing memoirs. That's why the Holocaust Library was set up. I was the editor of the Holocaust Library by survivors. It took 20 years before books were published about the Holocaust.
Often associated with the Eichmann trial as a pivot point.
That was a pivot point, absolutely. So the survivors, therefore, kept to themselves. When I had my 70th birthday here in Los Angeles, and my closest male friends came, and I spoke about each one and how they contributed to my life, I realized that all of them except one, their fathers were Auschwitz survivors. Even at that stage, through my whole life, my closest friends, and I didn't even know that some of them, you know, had fathers who were in Auschwitz until that moment. So it just gives you an idea of how outside of the mainstream our community was. And that's why we wanted to investigate, how did that shape us? How did it shape our values, our choices of occupation, you know, what we do with our life and what we're doing with our life still?
Both Marty and you write independently of a very, very marked and really quite almost cinematically charged emotional response that your parents acted out. You both describe your parents respectively in moments of overwhelm or despair as beating the sides of their heads. Both of you also describe independently how harrowing it was for each of you to witness this. I want to give you the opportunity to talk about the experience because it's so compelling. But I also want to ask you a second question, which I really hope you'll think out loud with me about, which is, to what do you attribute the similarity of this very distinctive physical response to what appears to be an outburst of despair?
Well, in my case, this happened when I was very young, when my mother just couldn't cope with the situation, especially if I did something that she disapproved of. She would get so frustrated that she would bang her head with her fist so hard that it just stopped me in my tracks, and it was very hard to cope with. It was only many years later, actually, because my mother is alive. She's 105, and I still go to her for questions. And out of the blue, she said, "You know, when you were a little boy, you used to bang your head against the wall all the time." And I didn't know this. And then I was thinking, why would I be banging my head against the wall? I've always believed that the victimization that our parents experienced of being robbed of choice, of being made into slaves, disposable slaves, I think they always carried that sense of victimization. And I think that beating themselves is an echo of that. There's so much pain and sorrow that existed. Even when it was unspoken, it was so much there that I coped with it in two ways. One is to beat my head against the wall. And my earliest memory is I thought that Hitler was still alive and that my goal would be to shoot him. And my sister, 5 years younger, who was born in Cleveland, she told me she had a dream that Hitler was caught. He was found guilty of war crimes. And he was sentenced to be put in a large glass container, about maybe 10 foot tall. And he would have to be in the container, and ladders would be put up against the sides of the container, and people would spit down until he drowned. That was her dream. And Marty had a dream, even though his parents never talked about it, but his mother did mention the word Hitler. But what Hitler did to us, that's all he knew. He had a dream of flying over Germany and dropping glass on Germany as a young boy. So these are just some of the scenes of growing up in this intense atmosphere. My sister told me yesterday, I'm staying with her, she said, "I used to look at other girls in school, and they were so carefree. And yet I couldn't be like that." So we have always carried this burden and still do. In the foreword, Dr. Danielli points out that we still cannot fully appreciate moments of joy without that underlying sense of sadness. I had this experience a few years ago. We were sitting at the Shabbos table at our house with our grandchildren. And as my wife was lighting the candles, I saw the reflection of the candles in the eyes of my grandchildren. And suddenly I thought of the 1.5 million children who are murdered just like them. It just came over me in this beautiful moment at the Shabbat table. So I didn't say anything, of course. I just let it pass and then went on with the rest of the evening. It just hits you sometimes because it's always there.
I want to go back to a theme that you spoke about earlier, which is the difference in your families and your experiences with respect to silence. Yours differed from Marty's in that your parents, as you described a few moments ago, did speak, if admittedly in limited fashion, about the Holocaust. Meanwhile, Marty's didn't speak about it at all. If you had to make a traditional pro and con column on the issue of silence, tell us what you think were some of the costs of silence, but ponder, if you would, maybe the fact that there are perhaps some benefits to silence. I don't know. I'm asking.
Well, I asked my mother in an interview with her, did she ever consider not telling me about the Holocaust? And she said, "Never. You had to know the truth. How else could you ever understand me?" And another occasion, after accompanying her to the 50th anniversary of her liberation in the Czech Republic. There was a 50th anniversary where the survivors of the death march came together for the first time and only time. And on the bus, as we were leaving, she said to me, she said, "I'm so glad I brought you and your sister here, because now you understand what's truly important in life and what is not important." That is the lesson. And one other lesson has to do with faith. She really believed that her survival was God protecting her because of the righteousness of her father. My father had a very different take on it. Now, Marty's parents didn't talk about it. So what are the repercussions? Marty didn't know until he was 20 years old, as I said earlier, that his father had a family. He had two sisters who perished in the Holocaust. Somewhere deep inside of him, he always knew that. Because even as a young child, you know, if he heard on the news that some parents lost children, a child died, he would cry for the parents. Once Marty learned what happened, really knew what happened, he thought he would never get married. He says, I could never stand to lose a child, so I'm not going to get married and have children. So he was married 10 years after I was married, but he met somebody and he fell in love, and that changed. And then we talked to his kids. They just talked about how overprotective and cautious he was. So, you know, it just carries on. My feeling is you can't hide the trauma. It comes through, whether you talk about it or not. So if it's going to come through, I prefer to talk about it. I talk to my children about it. He didn't talk to his children about it, but they asked about it because they knew. So he would respond to them. He wouldn't initiate, actually. But I feel that, you know, I was able to handle it better and to deal with it better because I knew, and I made it part of my life's work to know more. I just didn't know much more about my own family, but I knew a hell of a lot about the Holocaust because I was the editor-in-chief of the Holocaust Library Publishing House. I was Elie Wiesel's editor for his collected works. I lived in that world. And I used my position as editor of Dafka and then Reform Judaism to keep the Holocaust front and center. Dafka was the first publication to deal with the issue that the Holocaust was not being taught in religious schools. And that was while I was a student at HUC in the School of Education. And to the credit of HUC, they understood that my field is Jewish education, not in the classroom, but through journalism. And I used that. So it served me well, but I did intellectualize it a bit. Then that was a problem.
And it sounds like if you had to make the table of pros and cons, you don't see any pros to silence.
Well, you know, I could only talk about my own experience. Marty and I, we inherited the trauma, but we also inherited a great deal of love. The love outweighed the trauma. I can't say that for every child who survived. I can't speak for others. Every case is different. And sometimes some parents who perhaps are so traumatized that they just cannot talk to their kids about it for fear of traumatizing their children or for whatever reason. Some Holocaust survivors committed suicide.
Yeah.
I mean, Art Spiegelman, if you take his situation, his mother committed suicide. She had lost a child in the Holocaust. In first marriage, I believe. And, you know, he was in a mental institution for a while. The pain and suffering and the difficult relationship he had with his father, it all came out in his art. It was very painful. So his situation is very different from our situation.
Above and beyond the actual information and things that you and Marty learned from each other, with each other in the course of writing this book, what surprised you about writing this book, the process, the experience?
My biggest surprise was how I'd never spoken to my father about it. And the only other person who survived in his family was a brother. There were four brothers, four daughters, and parents. Two brothers survived. One moved to Argentina from the DP camp, and the other moved to North America. since 1968, I had a memoir written in Spanish by my uncle in my library collecting dust. He had asked me to translate it from Yiddish to English when I was in Argentina for his daughter's wedding because I was a writer and an editor. And yet I didn't. And I wrote books about the Romanian Holocaust. I wrote, you know, so many other things. But that book, I didn't crack open until we wrote this book. So I would say it was very surprising to me that for someone who was a Holocaust educator and some even said a scholar, to be so ignorant of what happened to my own family, that was an awakening moment to realize how I had suppressed it myself.
Aaron Hurt-Mannheimer, thank you so much for the pleasure of your company, for the conversation, and for sharing so much of yourself and your story with us here on the College Commons podcast.
I really appreciate being here. Thank you.
We hope you've enjoyed this episode of the College Commons podcast, available wherever you listen to your podcasts. And check out HUC Connect, compelling conversations at the forefront of Jewish learning. For more information about all that HUC Connect has to offer, visit huc.edu/HUC Connect.